Our first speaker today is Melvin Backstrom. He's a PhD candidate in musicology at McGill University, teaching courses in the history of popular music and working on a dissertation on the relations between musical modernism, the avant-garde, and popular music in the San Francisco Bay Area from 1960 to 1975. He holds diplomas in jazz guitar performance and recording arts, and has worked professionally as a guitarist, a BA, combined honors in music and philosophy, an MA in musicology, and is in his sixth year as a graduate research assistant with the Improvisation Community and Social Practice Research Project. And so without further ado, I will turn things over to Melvin.
Thank you very much, Christina. Beginning in the early 1990s, a musical genre known most commonly by the appellation of jam band gained increasing recognition as of significant import to the North American music industry. Since then, groups associated with it have consistently been among the most profitable touring acts each year, and live music festivals featuring all or mostly jam band groups have consistently been among the largest and most successful. As well, some have argued that on account of its success, the jam band genre has much to teach the wider music industry concerning how to respond to increased copyright infringement due to copy music digitization, the decline in sales of compact discs, and developing and maintaining a fan base. But despite these facts, there has been so far been relatively little scholarly work done to explore its history, how its performers and audience members understand it, and what role it plays in the broader field of North American popular music. This lack, I would argue, is perhaps best explained by the genre's overt hybridity and consequent problematic position within the overall music field. Although significantly influenced by the improvisatory aesthetic of jazz, its use of pop music's forms and singing styles causes it to lack the cultural capital that attends to jazz, while holding itself somewhat aloof from the marketing mechanisms and discursive field of pop. Thus, it often falls in the cracks between their structures of scholarly representation. In particular, jam bands have been underrecognized in understandings of the role that various kinds of labor play in the way in which musical value is defined. For though having strong links to the rock music tradition, the genre significantly differs from it in the crucial role that the labor of improvisation plays in its performances, both by performers on stage and by audience members through their physical and mental engagement with the performers and music through dancing. Although commonly considered a sub-branch of rock in general agreement with its values and ideologies, I would argue that on account of the critical valuing of performer improvisation and audience dancing within it, the jam band genre in fact represents a significant break from rock. And it is this break that explains, I think, why electronic dance music, a meta-genre understood by many as pretty much antithetical to rock, and jam bands have interwoven to such a degree that there now exists a hybrid of the two, live-tronica or jam-tronica. Such a synthesis suggests the need to rethink some older assumptions about the connections between contemporary popular music genres, and therefore of redefining, following Bourdieu, the field of popular music more broadly. As Bourdieu and others have pointed out, the development of autonomy has been the crucial factor in defining the value of cultural production since the split between high art and popular culture around the beginning of the 19th century. In the 20th century, increasing autonomy manifested itself most significantly in the history of popular music at two key points. First, the transformation of jazz into a quasi-art music in the 1940s with the innovations of bebop. Second, the transformation of rock and roll into rock through the poetic lyricism of Bob Dylan and the musical innovations of the Beatles in the mid-60s. So here's sort of a general binary comparing the two of rock and pop. In both of these instances, the rejection of audience dancing was a crucial part of the autonomizing process on account of how such a clearly functional role for music was so subversive to their claims of artistic autonomy. For it was precisely the assertion of their status as artists producing music meant for concentrated listening rather than mere entertainers playing music for dancers that justified jazz's separation from popular music and later rock music's separation from pop. And here's a great video that I always come back to. Love to show my students. This is 1967, Roger Waters and Syd Barrett of Pink Floyd in discussion with an interviewer.
You did start, if I'm not mistaken, as a group which accompanied dancing, is that it?
Yeah, you could say that.
And how did you turn into a concertizing group, if I may use the American term?
Well, we've only done two concerts, in fact,
yes.
Because the main scene with pop music, which I guess is what we are at the moment, is that you play gigs around ballrooms and dance halls and this sort of scene, because that's how it works at the moment. But we felt that there was no real reason, you know, why we shouldn't do an organized concert in a large hall where people came and sat and actually listened to what we do, because dance halls, generally speaking, are not very good places to actually listen to the music. Most people come along, and the music, for most of them, has been, over the past few years anyway, just a sort of background noise that they can jig about to.
I love that. You know, you could say that we're a pop group. Pop music, which is, I guess, what we are. Music, you know, is a background to jiggle about to. But we want, you know, serious, you know, listeners to sit down and listen to what we do. We don't want the dancers. God forbid that. And I love Pink Floyd. I know he's, you know, I love their music and one of my most important musical influences, but I find it interesting. However, it was not until the enormous success of the film Saturday Night Fever and its accompanying soundtrack that explicit hostility to music unambiguously intended for dancing exploded among many rock music fans and critics. Their opposition to disco was certainly not only because of its clearly functional nature, and many have pointed to the clear racism and homophobia at work as well, but it undoubtedly served to justify for many what they perceived as its essential pop character. Its concomitant lack of value and betrayal of rock's paradoxical mixture of musical tradition and progressivity.
Disco sucks! Disco sucks! And we're never gonna let them forget it! They're not gonna shove it down our throats! We rock and rollers will resist, and we will triumph!
Every day I would play a disco record and drag the needle across it, you know, and scratch it and then blow it up. But I tapped into something. There's an undercurrent of hatred for disco.
Watching the fans slide down that foul pole was like, oh my God.
I mean, the field was on fire. You know, it was on fire. I've never seen a baseball field on fire before.
There's some highlights from the infamous Disco Demolition Derby that, you know, some people pointed to as having killed disco. But I think you can see the degree of vehemence that was felt by many, by the rock and rollers. We, you know, we're never going to let them forget. They're not going to shove it down our throats. We rock and rollers will resist and we will triumph. And though disco ostensibly died around 1980, the dance music genre that came to take its place in the 1980s continued to face the same opprobrium from rock critics and fans through appeals to the importance of those qualities that rock possessed and dance music lacked. So it was for Simon Frith to attack such rock ideology in his article, Art Versus Technology, The Strange Case of Popular Music. In it, he persuasively problematizes discourses of authenticity in rock music, specifically the ways in which technology is often opposed in musical discourse to nature, community, and art. He traces the strength of such oppositions through debates over canned versus live music, and the related ways in which the degree of apparent physical labor by performers has been understood as one of the defining metrics for the authenticity of rock, in contrast with the inauthenticity of pop from the mid-1950s onward. On Frith's account, not only does technology not subvert the authenticity otherwise ostensibly inherent in live music, but the whole notion of musical authenticity is fundamentally flawed, of purely ideological significance. Furthermore, while authenticity is often seen as the quality most determinative of rock music's claims to realize an anti-corporate, vaguely leftist, progressive politics, the opposite is in fact the case. Record company profits are defended against new technology in the language of individual creativity. Now, this is a powerful critique, and I think there is a great deal of truth to it, especially when applied to Springsteen-like rock music. But I want to use the jam band genre to push back against Frith's wholesale discounting of the importance of genuine spontaneity and of the continued opposition of liveness and physical labor to obvious technological mediation. For in contrast to the flamboyant displays of effort of Springsteen and most other rock performers, jam band musicians are for the most part notable on account of their lack of overt physicality. Onstage movements other than that required to play an instrument or sing and between song banter are minimal, if not entirely non-existent. Furthermore, unlike the so-called improvisations of a performer like James Brown repeating the more or less identical performance night after night, for the jam band community, the question of whether musicians allow for genuine spontaneity in their performances and whether it provokes parallel spontaneity through dancing in the audience is extremely important. Indeed, it is crucial to the very definition of the genre. Two of its key characteristics, the obsessive recording of performances by jam band fans and desire to see as many shows as possible, are at least partly due, I would argue, to the need to ascertain and experience the differences in performance resulting from the labor of spontaneity that is so integral to defining the genre. For it is not the explicit use of technology tout court that is problematic to the jam band's sense of authenticity, as Frith points to for rock, but rather its use that unduly limits the freedom of performers to structurally improvise in response to spontaneous suggestions of band members or feedback from the audience, such as by segueing from one song into another, extending a particular section, or improvising freely outside of any pre-existent formal structures. The acceptance of overt technological mediation by jam bands relates to another limitation, I think, of Frith's critique. To the contradiction between older, quote, rock and roll ideals of spontaneity, energy, and effort, and new emphases on sensitivity, care, and control, unquote, coming from the advent of the idea of rock musicians as serious artists, Bob Dylan, the Beatles as the first exemplars, he recognizes two solutions offered by 1970s rock. Quote, on the one hand, effort and control were combined in the spectacular technological displays of art rock groups like Pink Floyd and stadium rockers like Led Zeppelin. On the other hand, singer-songwriters like Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, and even John Lennon used studio devices and sonic collages to reveal themselves more openly, making music a matter of individual sensibilities that couldn't be engaged in the crude collective setting of the concert hall, unquote. Now, these should, of course, be understood as poles between which many gradations are possible rather than an either-or dichotomy, since many groups use, or both, or move between them at various points. But in addition to these two possibilities, and in contrast, as Frith also points out, to their shared realization of the recording studio as the most important rock instrument, the Grateful Dead, the group that defined the jam band genre more than any other, I think created or suggested or reimagined a third possibility that is now one of the genre's primary characteristics, that is the live concert as instrument. That is, instead of a concert's primary goal as the reproduction of songs as similar as possible to a pre-existent studio recording, as is traditionally the case for most popular music, for jam bands, the music is but a means, an instrument to achieve the manifestation of an alternative community, a space in which peak experiences, the transcendence of everyday reality, can be encouraged to optimally occur. It is not the individual musician or privileged group members who are, in such a context, the locus of autonomous creativity, the ideology, Frith points out, so integral to rock music, but rather the communal, symbiotic engagement of musicians and audience. Now, David Tetzlaff, in a critique of Frith, points to the relation that such an understanding has with the above discussion of authenticity. So whereas Frith treats authenticity rather univocally, that of the autonomous artist genius that defined rock music from the late 1960s onward, Tetzlaff points to the differences between the authenticity of early rock and roll and the punk rock that has spent decades trying to revive that, and that of the rock aesthetic that was invented in the mid-1960s. So, quote, rock and roll locates its sense of musical truth in the expression of aggression, positive or negative, against restricting social mores and conventions. At its root is a sort of inchoate politics, an assertion that all is not right with the world, that the situation must be faced up to with an emotional attack, a testimony to the frustration of things as they are and the joy of violating the rules. The rock and roll aesthetic demands honesty to our emotional responses to daily life. Generally, as experienced within a subculture or community, it defines as subordinate. This is a very different matter than the authenticity of autonomous artistry idealized by the ideology of progressive rock. Now, I find this distinction useful because it points to the very hybridity of the jam band genre that largely explains, I think, the lack of scholarly attention is hitherto received. For not only do jam bands sit uneasily between jazz and pop music structures of media representation, but also between these two different understandings of authenticity, aspiring on one hand to the creation of a non-compromised autonomous musical expression, but as the expression of a countercultural community rather than that of the individual genius of a band or a single musician. In other words, and somewhat paradoxically, a collective autonomy. I'm going to jump forward a little bit because I feel like I'm running out of time, but I feel it is also in terms of such a hybrid understanding of authenticity that one can understand one of the most intriguing musical characteristics of jam bands, their rejection of the progressive teleology of rock and of modern art more generally through the performance of highly complex, challenging music, making use of many of the sonic techniques of 20th century musical modernism, atonality, electronic noise, aleatoric techniques, and so forth, alongside music that is its complete opposite in terms of cultural prestige, cover versions or originals in the style of country and western, bluegrass, and early rock and roll songs. As numerous scholars have pointed out, although rock musicians from the mid-60s on have found their origins in these genres, their identity largely depends on the idea that they have outgrown their youthful simplicity and are artists rather than the mere entertainers of earlier popular music, a key component of which is an insistence on musical originality. And here again, Roger Waters, quote, "We always felt right from the beginning that there could be more to rock and roll than standing on stage playing Johnny B. Goode," unquote. There could, in some ways, thus be few more puzzling actions than for a group of rock musicians to regularly include in their repertoire cover versions of simple, well-known songs, when they have many other original songs of far greater complexity that they could perform instead. Yet such inclusivity is quite normal within the jam band genre, along with the composition and performance of original songs in relatively simple and overt rock and roll, country, or R&B styles. A notable example of the musical incongruity that results is a March 23, 1975 performance by the Grateful Dead, where after a continuous 32 minutes of almost entirely instrumental music of a highly experimental modernist variety, based on their song Blues for Allah, the group played in seemingly ironic counterpart to the progressive aspirations of Pink Floyd, Johnny B. Goode. Such musical variegation's rejection of modernist teleology also connects to the continuing importance of the labor of the audience through dancing within the jam band genre. For not surprisingly, the deliberately functional role of the music significantly influenced the music itself. The long instrumental improvised solos and segues between songs that so define the jam band aesthetic developed out of a desire to satisfy an audience that did not want to stop dancing every few minutes, but to experience the performance as an unbroken flow of dance, rhythm, lights, and sound. And though the Grateful Dead were by no means unique among rock groups in the late 70s in recording and performing songs strongly influenced by the then popularity of disco, that these remained part of the repertoire long after its popularity had passed, at least in North America, speaks, I think, to the primary importance that overtly danceable rhythms played in their music. But these facts point to other differences from the ideology of rock critiqued by Frith. Although the music that rock groups perform is obviously informed by the desires of its existent and or expected audience, rock music's ideal of autonomy necessitates that this be largely denied in order for musicians to assert themselves as bona fide artists. In fact, the opposition to dancing of many musicians wedded to such an understanding of artistic authenticity from bebop to rock is, I would argue, on account of dancing's undeniable affirmation of the connection between audience members' physical pleasure and musicians' choices. It therefore runs counter to claims of music's autonomy as the ostensible expression of individualistic genius. Not only can audience desires not be acknowledged to determine the constitution of music that professes such an autonomous aesthetic, at least positively, but informed by a residual Cartesian mind-body dualism, physical pleasure, at least that which is not clearly of an aggressive masculine variety, is often seen as essentially suspect, and at best distraction from the infinitely more valuable engagement of the mind. Given the importance of audience dancing to the jam band genre, the role of the DJ in contemporary electronic dance culture makes for an obvious comparison. Now, many scholars have argued that DJs offer an alternative performance style to that which exists in either the Western art or rock music worlds. And what I find interesting, I'm going to jump forward a little bit since I'm running out of time, DJing has been seen as offering a third possibility to, say, Western art music and rock culture. And Michelle Irving, on her very interesting thesis on interpretive practice in laptop music, suggests this. But what is particularly relevant for my purposes here is how obviously and applicable the role of DJs is to jam bands as well. Rather than a single individual manipulating and blending pre-recorded music to affect these results, as is the case with DJ culture, they are instead realized by a group of primarily live musicians. The means are different, but the desired results are indeed the same. And it is this commonality of means and purposes between jam bands and DJ culture that explains the live or jamtronica synthesis that has taken place between them in the last 15 or so years. A seemingly remarkable development from the perspective of the 1980s when the relations between rock and dance music culture were, as Frith then pointed out, almost wholly oppositional. Yet it is only remarkable if one ignores the significant differences between the rock ideology that Frith critiques and the jam band genre whose roots stretch back to the improvisation-laden music of the late 1960s, but that really began to coalesce in the late 80s and early 90s with the mainstream success of the Grateful Dead and the increasing popularity of groups like Phish, Widespread Panic, and Blues Traveler that followed in the Dead's wake. Today, live or Jamtronica groups such as the Disco Biscuits, Sound Tribe Sector 9, Lotus, and Particle all have the standard rock instrumentation of electric guitar, bass, and drums. But they also prominently feature synthesizers, sequencers, samplers, and a panoply of electronic dance music's sounds, rhythms, and textures. And I just want to play a brief example. Point. Indeed, some of these groups, these live Jamtronica groups, will sometimes do live PA sets where most or all of the instrumentalists will perform on sequencers and laptops rather than their traditional rock instruments. And I had an example to show, but I'll skip that for now. What makes jam bands a particularly interesting object of study in this light is their foregrounding of the labor of improvisation and therefore of difference of entire performances, the style of individual songs, the diversity of actions of performers and audience members, as the paradoxical expression of a desired countercultural unity. But rather than enacting a reactionary nostalgia for that which some profess existed in San Francisco during the halcyon hippie days of the 1960s, as some might still dismissively argue, or simply yet another variant of rock music dependent on the same artistic values as all the others that have appeared since rock's inception in the mid-60s, the jam band genre, though largely finding its origins in the rock music of this period, now finds itself having more in common with, as well as informing and being informed by, contemporary electronic dance music than with most current rock music. The genre is a vital, evolving, and thoroughly contemporary one that in its rejection of modernist autonomy and an assertion of the necessity of connections between art and life has, following Peter Berger, perhaps more in common with the historical avant-garde than does the post-war musical modernism that claimed the heritage of the avant-garde, yet embraced the very aesthetic autonomy that was precisely the target of many of the avant-garde's early 20th century manifestations. Such an account requires rethinking the place of jam bands within today's musical genre field, a process I've hopefully begun here, as well as the history of popular music over the last 30 years to understand what has brought such seemingly opposed musical forms as electronic dance and the apparent rock of jam bands into such close and intimate association. And thank you very much for listening. I hope I didn't go over too much. We're taking questions now, or?
Well, I think so, and that's sort of what I was trying to get at. In that, from the perspective of the 1980s, it seems almost completely absurd. You know, given you watch that disco demolition derby, and the sense of complete opposition between dance culture and rock culture. They're just radically opposed, and yet, you know, even at that point, you did have, and certainly, you know, the Grateful Dead, I think, were one of the primary examples of a rock band, you know, that was at the same time very much about dancing and about the affirmation of audience involvement and audience pleasure through physical engagement with the music. And so what I'm suggesting is that actually, you know, kind of is a way of making sense of how in the 1990s, I think it's very absolutely the case, and certainly now, and certainly we see examples of that today, how those things have come back together. And yes, absolutely, during the 1990s, there was such a synthesis of sorts that happens where, yeah, people were going to Phish concerts and people were going into the, you know, seeing the Chemical Brothers. And what makes it all work is that it was all about that affirmation of physical pleasure and about audience engagement. And that, I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to get past that idea from the 1980s that these two are radically opposed. And there are ways, I think, of looking back and seeing how there is actually connections that all the way back to the 1960s. And so I hope that somewhat answers it.
Yeah, I see two points there that I wanted to take on between community and venue size, kind of an undercurrent thing. And
between community and venue size?
Yeah,
okay.
Something that I'm just pulling together in my own mind. That if you start, well, there's this idea of community, community improvisation,
Well, I think I agree that there's, you know, one can see example, you know, once one gets into the minutiae, there's obviously there's improvisation everywhere, constantly in everything that we're doing. But I think there is definitely not the the difference, I would say, in punk and certainly in a lot of the rock bands I've played in, is that there isn't the foregrounding of improvisation and the foregrounding of difference of actually trying to change things. And actually play differently every time. And that's actually a goal, to actually, you know, reflect the difference of the performance in the constitution and in the very structures of the music, is I think an important qualitative difference between what you see in most popular music and what I'm talking about. And I think the difference being is that I think the role of the audience, certainly the venue size is a enormous factor, and obviously in a smaller venue, there's far more room to engage with the audience, absolutely. But what I find interesting is how the even in these larger situations, and certainly of jam bands and of electronic dance culture, how that connection between the audience is precisely the priority, is exactly what is being foregrounded at that point. Does that get to your question, or like? Although the thing that I see with moshing is that I find it quite exclusive. It's and the aggression of it I find very limiting in terms of the variety of actions that one can engage with as a performer. I find it actually quite exclusive because of the aggression that's involved. Although, you know, I've certainly been in mosh pits where, yes, there is, you know, if you fall down, people will pick you up and help you out. But I find in general, the amount of actions that are sort of allowed in that are fairly limited, just because of the situation that you're in, of this circle that's spinning around and people being thrown around, and it's I find it quite different than a situation why is that okay versus say the disco situation. I think because, you know, the moshing is so hyper masculinist. It's the aggressiveness sort of shields it from the critique of, oh, you know, well, you know, it, you know, dancing is somehow, you know, suspect, you know, but because moshing is so hyper masculine, it actually it's acceptable in ways that certainly disco dancing was seen as being so, you know, egregious to the rock idea. Am I getting to what you're saying here? Okay, yeah, I don't know what more to say right there. But.
I think we have one more quick question.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking through this in a way. It's very interesting. I'm thinking back to, regular Adorno, like a standardization. I'm wondering, is there a moment where there's a kind of change in the music industry that allows for improvisation? And even to go to things like, well, mosh is really formulaic. You know what it's kind of mosh when you're, there's certain structures, but there seems to be a gap in there.
where, you know, improvisation was allowed and genre movement was allowed. I mean, were there kind of changes in the nature of the industry that opened up these doors for?
Well, I think certainly in the, you know, in the late 60s there was, because of the popularity of psychedelic rock and the dancing that was almost expected as part of that. But, you know, it really, once sort of rock ideology takes hold in the 1970s, it really, you know, pushes that out. And I think partly one of the reasons why the Grateful Dead, who kept doing that, were kind of, you know, increasingly ignored by the broader industry, was precisely because they kept doing that. They didn't follow along with the sort of the ascribing of dancing of an audience engagement, and then again, you know, when disco takes hold in the mid to late 70s and becomes such so influential, again, it's precisely, I think, because of its threat to rock ideology. And so when the jam band synthesis comes to or starts to take hold in the late 80s and early 90s, I think that starts to bring that back, and I think that connects to a broader, you know, increasing popularity of rave and dance culture, electronic dance culture that is also taking hold at the same time. So I guess I'm trying to get over this wholesale opposition between rock and dance culture, and trying to see that it's actually, you know, goes back a long time, and that we shouldn't ignore that. Thank you very much.